From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The first uterus transplant in the United States failed this week. The Cleveland Clinic transplanted a cadaver uterus to a 26-year-old woman, Lindsay, on February 24th. On Monday of this week, they announced that news. Yesterday, the clinic announced that the uterus had been removed after serious complications. But this is already being done abroad successfully, and more transplants are planned here. It's about women longing for a biological child that they carry themselves in pregnancy. This hour, how far will we go? We're on the frontier of uterine transplants. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you welcome the news that a woman was able to get a uterine transplant? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at a new procedure that will shorten the wait times for thousands of people seeking kidney transplants. But first, to those headlines you must have seen earlier this week about the transplanted uterus in Ohio. Here was Dr. Rebecca Flicht. She was part of the team. Everybody saw them in photographs or on television. The Cleveland Clinic to transplant the first uterus into a woman in the United States. Earlier this week, here she was explaining why a woman might elect to have such an invasive surgery.
What motivates women with uterine factor infertility to pursue other options is that experience of carrying the pregnancy, of feeling the baby grow and develop, and of getting to be there for the baby's birth.
And then the young woman herself, 26 years old from Texas, identified only as Lindsay, but we could see her there. She was in a wheelchair, the transplanted uterus already in. First thing she did was thank the family of the young woman who had died and whose uterus had been donated so that she could have it.
Thank you all for coming today. First and foremost, I would like to take a moment to express the immense gratitude I feel towards my donor's family. They have provided me with a gift that I will never be able to repay, and I am beyond thankful for them.
That was Lindsay on Monday, and of course she would be thankful, and they must have taken a loss. This is from someone who, had died. Lindsay was told at 16 that she would never have children. Here she was talking about that moment.
And from that moment on, I have prayed that God would allow me the opportunity to experience pregnancy.
The opportunity to experience pregnancy, and hopes were high on Monday that she would have that opportunity. Interesting, she has three adopted children, but it was that carrying of the baby in pregnancy that she was looking for with the transplanted uterus. Joining me now from Omaha, Nebraska, is Dr. Alex Maskin, surgical director of the Kidney Pancreas Transplant Program at Nebraska Medicine. He is there initiating a uterine transplant program. Dr. Maskin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, thank you very much. How are you?
We're okay. And first, let's just talk for a minute about what we know about what's happened with this Cleveland Clinic transplant. There was a lot of joy, I have to say, on Monday in Lindsay, who we just heard there, and of course, the medical staff. Do you have any idea exactly what went wrong with this transplant, Dr. Maskin?
I do not. I know the team very well. I have not spoken to them recently about, unfortunately, what happened. You know, when we think about complications in transplant, whether it be uterus, kidney, liver, really whatever organ we transplant, there's kind of three general reasons why a transplant could fail. One is immunological, whether an issue of rejection. The second is kind of a technical problem where there's a problem either sewing in the arteries or the veins connecting to the transplant. And the third is kind of a general broad kind of category of infection or later on noncompliance with the recipient or kind of a general broad category. You know, it's unclear to me which of the three occurred in this case at this time.
All I know is that uterus has come back out, and it must be traumatic for everybody. I mean, it's a lot to go through, and expectations were running high. And, of course, it has been done abroad, 9 of these transplants done in Sweden, 5 children born out of those, 4, I think I understand, still alive. Can you just walk us through? I mean, you do kidney transplant, I guess pancreas as well. How does the transplant of a uterus work? Can you just take us through the broad steps involved in doing this?
Sure. In deceased donors, at the time of the procurement, where a transplant surgeon is harvesting the organs, the uterus is harvested at the same time. Different arteries and veins for the uterus obviously supply things such as the liver or the kidney.
Mm-hmm.
And the uterus is procured. It's flushed with cold preservative solution to preserve it, the same solution that we use in livers or kidney or pancreas. At the same time, the recipient is undergoing an operation where she is opened up, and the vessels that are used to that the uterus will be sewn to are mobilized. And in general, it's sewn to similar vessels that a kidney transplant would be done. They're called the iliac vessels, I-L-I-A-C.
Okay.
And they're kind of in the lower pelvis, and we have one set on each side. And the uterine artery and vein, there's one on each side. Those are sewn to the recipient's iliac artery and vein on each side.
Okay.
And then the cervix, or part of the cervix from the donor, is then sewn to the recipient's vagina. And so it's a procedure where the uterus is basically placed in the position that it would normally have resided in.
Is it connected essentially then to the recipient in the same way that a natural uterus would be, embedded?
Correct.
As a transplant surgeon, how would you describe, and I know you're just headed toward doing this, but I'm sure you've studied it a lot, the degree of difficulty of this transplant? I mean, it seems so much right in the middle of everything.
Yeah. We haven't done one at Nebraska Medicine yet.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to my colleagues extensively in Sweden. It's a pretty long operation. I think there's a steep learning curve at the beginning. But I think that's true for any major surgical procedure and certainly any major transplant. 20, 30 years ago, a kidney transplant may have taken 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. And now a routine kidney transplant could be done in less than 2 hours. So I think there's a steep learning curve, and once more and more done, different exposure, different techniques used, different ways to facilitate the operation will be developed, and it will decrease the time spent doing the operation.
I think
it took them around 9-10 hours.
You describe the uterus as coming from a deceased donor, and of course it
Correct.
Did in this case, but I think that in Sweden they have used living donors as well.
Yes.
How's that decision made? Which way to go? And who would be a uterus donor?
In Sweden, all their 9 donors were living donors. The reason for that is that the laws and governing bodies in terms of deceased donors in Sweden and Europe is significantly different than the United States. So their initial thought was it would be much more difficult to obtain permission and to obtain donors for deceased donors in Europe than we have in the United States. So that's what initially started their idea to use living donors. In the United States, I think the ethical considerations are slightly different. As you may be aware, there's a significant amount of risk and there's a significant amount of concern regarding live living donors and transplant in the United States, whether it be liver or kidney, and then great care is devoted to their safety during the operation. It was our belief and some of the other teams in the United States' belief that undergoing an experimental procedure, which may, on the donor side as well, take 10 to 12 hours
Wow.
for a non-life-saving procedure, initially at least was a bit fraught with risk. And we were initially unwilling to do a 10 to 12-hour procedure on a living donor before we became facile with the operation.
Yeah, I can understand that. Is it clear or is it obvious to you which would be likely more successful for the transplant itself? I know there are a lot of considerations here, but living or from a deceased donor, which seems more promising to be successful?
Well, theoretically, a living donor is always more successful. We have numerous experience in living donor kidney transplants, living donor living transplants, and they're just better organs. They get transplanted faster. They're coming from healthier donors.
Mm-hmm.
So theoretically, a living donor should be much better. Since so few have been done in the uterus transplant population, it's not quite clear yet which ultimately would be quote-unquote better. But theoretically, a living donor should be better.
Describe how all this works. If you do get a uterus transplant and you're looking to become pregnant and to carry that baby. That's the point of it.
Correct.
But the impregnation is done by in vitro fertilization.
Correct.
Why that way instead of the old-fashioned way? Mechanically, would it work, or does it have to be IVF?
It has to be IVF because there is significant concern that when during the operation I described, you connect the donor cervix to the recipient vagina, and there's a lot of concern that this anastomosis, this connection, will inhibit impregnation via the conventional means.
Okay.
And additionally, that area may be scarred or things of that nature. And also, I'm sure you know, at the end, when it's all the births are performed by cesarean section.
And why is that? For the same reason that they're worried about those connections.
Right.
Not wanting to stress them.
Worried about a normal vaginal delivery. A lot of the women that are genetically born without uteruses also have malformed vaginas as well. So there's significant concern that there'd be stress on the child trying to be born with a vaginal delivery.
There's so much we want to learn here about. I'm reading maybe 50,000 women in the United States might be candidates for this. That seems like a large number. On the other hand, it's a big surgery, as you describe it. Do you see this as ever becoming routine, or will this always, to your mind, be exotic?
You know, it's difficult to say. You know, I think 20, 30, 40 years ago, kidney transplant was viewed as exotic, and now more than 10,000 are done per year. Our aim and the main goal of the Swedish group is, as well, in 8 of their 9 women that they performed, is a disease commonly referred to as MRKH, or Mayer-Rokitansky-Kusterhauser. And this is a disorder that obviously only occurs in females, in which they're just genetically born without a uterus. And it's estimated that this occurs in approximately 1 in 5,000 women. And the story that Lindsay, the woman who received uterus transplant at Cleveland Clinic, her story is very similar. They don't know about it until they're young women of age 12 and 13, and they don't have a menstrual period.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new frontier in uterus transplants. The first in America failed this week in Ohio, but others have succeeded around the world. More are planned here. We're looking at how it works, why people want to do it, and whether it makes sense in ethical terms, cost terms. Of course, ultimately that may be between a woman and her doctor. One of the doctors who's looking at going into this and is working hard on it right now is Dr. Alex Maskin, with us today from Omaha, Nebraska, surgical director at the Kidney Pancreas Transplant Program at Nebraska Medicine. They're initiating a uterine transplant program there. Of course, we saw one failed this week at Cleveland Clinic, but there are others. Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas, Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston have announced similar pilot programs, I'm reading here. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Can you picture what's involved in a full uterus transplant? Were you shocked when you read the news that it's actually been done now in the U.S.? Have you heard that it failed? Can you understand why a woman would choose to have a uterus transplant, to go through all that? Would you go that far? Here's a little tape from Cleveland Clinic, and this is before the news of the failure of the transplant there. But this was Dr. Tommaso Falcone, chairman of the Women's Health Institute there, explaining in a video from the clinic what would have happened in the weeks after Lindsay's uterus transplant. This was the 26-year-old woman. This was a video taped before, ultimately, the uterus had to be removed.
Now, when she's going to start recovering and her ovarian function will return, produce estrogen, the estrogen will stimulate the uterus to produce the lining of the uterus, the endometrium, and then she will have a period. The uterus is an amazing organ. You know, it's basically on autopilot.
An amazing organ, basically on autopilot. Alex Maskin, Dr. Maskin in Omaha. I mean, that makes it sound simple. It's just on autopilot. I saw somebody describe it somewhere. This seemed kind of rugged, but as a garage for the fetus. I mean, is it simpler at some level than a kidney or a pancreas in its function?
I guess technically it is. As Dr. Falcone mentioned, it's a very complex organ, and you know the mechanisms of it are well understood. But as we know, it's not a life-saving organ. It doesn't provide, you know, filtration as a kidney or filter toxins as a liver. And certainly there's women who have a normal, healthy life without a uterus that do just fine. They just cannot, you know, have children. So in a sense, it is kind of what he described, but in a sense, it's also a very complex and well-understood organ as well.
Not life-saving, but it is certainly life-creating.
Correct.
We have callers for you, Dr. Maskin, in Omaha, Irma in Boston. Thank you for calling, Irma. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to say that I support urine transplant and transplants in general. And my question is, why is the United States second or third in doing this uterine transplant? And does Sweden and the United States medical teams share their techniques, or some of the techniques in Sweden, some important ones, are they kept proprietary?
Dr. Maskin?
We've shared everything extensively with Sweden. I personally visited Sweden twice in the last 6 months. I know their researchers well. They've shared all their data and techniques. So there is a significant amount of collaboration with the Swedish team. In regards to the caller's first question, the two main alternatives to uterus transplant are namely adoption or gestational surrogacy. Adoption in Europe and Sweden is significantly difficult, more difficult than it is in the United States in terms of the regulations and process that potential parents want to go through.
Interesting.
And in fact, gestational surrogacy is illegal in Sweden. So I think that the impetus in Sweden and in Europe was a little more advanced than it was here in the United States.
Because you can't hire a surrogate to carry the baby for you. What's the ethical construct that makes them reject that option, Dr. Maskin? Do you know?
I don't know the exact details of Swedish law. I think their government has concerns, as many people do in our country, with the contract, whether enforceable contracts that the parents undergo with a surrogate. You know, who mm-hmm. owns the child? What
yep.
happens if there's a complication during pregnancy? What happens if the mother does not want to give up the child? Things of that nature. You know, for whatever reason, the Swedish and some other countries in Europe have shied away from allowing surrogacy. So for Swedish women with this disease, their options were significantly more limited than they are in the United States.
And for Swedes who wanted that child, perhaps as well. Jane in Boston. Jane, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Love you. Love your show. Thank you for it. My condolences, first and foremost, to Lindsay. This topic, fraught with mental and physical repair long after the success of any transplant. And we can't forget that the uterus builds a human being.
Yeah.
And the desire of the woman to, like I said to your screener, hold her own. It is a frontier that ethical ? Exotic, definitely. But women are driven to carry, and I'm nobody to say you should or you should not, or why can't you be happy with your three adopted children, or
mm-hmm.
That is not for anyone to say. That
but do you understand how much women are willing to do, to what the extent women are willing to go to, Jane?
I sure do. I had my tubes tied and then reversed so I could have children. So I definitely know what, and thankfully, thanks to God that I was able to successfully carry two children post tubal ligation reversal.
Mm-hmm.
So, I definitely feel for these women. I had no idea the statistics of 1 in 5,000 women are born without a uterus.
That's amazing.
Staggering.
But but do I hear reservations about this? And are you?
Definitely. Mm. Definitely.
Yeah.
I think.
Why?
Personally, I just think that there's a reason. There's a reason. And like I said, also to your screener, science is definitely magnificent in what they've done and what they can do and how they can save lives and improve lives and change lives. But like you're posing the question yourself, is there a point? Is there a point of no return? Is there a point of too far? I just feel like this is like a little seesaw here.
How far do we go to have that experience of carrying the baby? I mean, we know how intimate and wonderful that can be, but how far. Jen, I really appreciate your call. Dr. Maskin in Omaha, please stand by. Also with us right now from New York is Dr. Tarneh Shirazian, gynecologist and surgeon in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Joan H. Tisch Center for Women's Health at NYU Langone Medical Center. She works with women hoping to get pregnant. Dr. Shirazian, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you describe to us the circumstances, I guess physical circumstances, of women who would be candidates for this? One, the MRKH disorder that Dr. Maskin described, they're born without a uterus. So, okay, that's obvious. Who else might be a candidate, Dr. Shirazian?
Well, there are many women who have surgeries that necessitate removal of the uterus. One of the most common issues that women face is actually something called uterine fibroids or leiomyomas. A fair number of women have leiomyomas, I would say almost 70% of the population. And so sometimes benign tumors like leiomyoma may jeopardize the function of the uterus, may necessitate a hysterectomy, as well as cancers of the cervix or the uterus that also may necessitate early removal of the uterus.
And does this 50,000 number sound reasonable to you in the United States that might be candidates?
I think so, because we include all of the women that have fibroids and potentially, you know, have premature removal of the uterus, and we include all the cases of cervical and uterine cancer, that number makes sense. As we stated earlier, the 1 in 5,000 women who are born without a uterus is actually a fairly small number overall of this larger number of women. So
Dr. Maskin was pointing out that at one time lots of transplants seemed unbelievable. And this, you know, the headline this week in the U.S. anyway, a uterus transplant, you look at it and you think, wow. And yet many women, and you work with women all the time with fertility issues, and they're looking in many different ways to figure out how to, and men, but women, how to address those. What do you think of this as an option? Is this something we should be charging into, you know, developing on a large scale, making commonly available?
Well, I think this is a first, let me say that I completely understand the desire for pregnancy. I do see it every day in the office. Women who want to bear children of their own, to carry pregnancies to term, to feel the baby moving, to experience delivery and or labor, which wouldn't be possible with this, but to have that experience of pregnancy and birth. So I completely understand that. And, you know, we go through great lengths sometimes to preserve uteri that have disease. So, you know, I'm talking about removing 50 fibroids from a uterus and hoping that the functionality of that uterus will still be intact after, you know, a large myomectomy for benign disease. And even that calls into question, well, 50 fibroids, you know, should we really be doing such extensive surgery? Big intervention, big surgery, blood loss, recovery, length of time in the operating room, anesthesia time. So, you know, so I understand the emotional desire and I understand the psychological desire. And I completely sympathize with women, you know, who want to get pregnant and to carry those pregnancies. So that I completely understand. But that aside, just dealing with sort of the medical risks and the surgery itself and the long-term consequences of being on these tumor rejection drugs, just the complications associated with having three abdominal surgeries, you know, all of those medical risks and complications that the mother takes on are extensive. And I think that, you know, many people would argue that it is even borderline, you know, too much, because we're talking about three surgeries. You know, how much should we, you know, should we sort of actively support women going through? As OBGYNs, you know, our patient group are women. So first and foremost, we take care of women. So very much my job is to counsel women on the risks and the benefits, and really to break down for them what they can expect from a surgery, what type of benefit they will gain from this surgery, which still remains unclear. you know, to go through everything and then not have a pregnancy
yeah.
would be, you know, astounding. So, you know, I think it definitely is a complicated issue. I think it's always nice to have many choices, but I think we always have to be responsible in how we counsel and how we educate women about their options.
Dr. Maskin, you're pushing there in Nebraska, Nebraska Medicine, to open a uterine transplant program. With all that difficulty, and presumably there's a cost element here as well, there are risks attendant with transplantation, of course. You hear the concerns that Dr. Shirazian raises. With all that, you're pushing forward. Why exactly?
Well, I certainly appreciate her considerations and her field. You know, I think it's very... And she touched on this a bit. I think it's very difficult to tell these women who desperately want to have a child, who desperately want to be able to carry their own pregnancy, sometimes to say no. I think in the United States today, and with any surgical procedure, whether it's a transplant or a minor surgery or an elective surgery, you know, there's a careful consideration of the risks and benefits that are in an informed consent that a patient and doctor have. And, you know, certainly it's a big surgery. There are risks, but I think that if those risks are carefully explained and the successes are understandable, you know, I think it's up to a lot of it's up to the woman and her partner to understand those risks and to decide for themselves whether or not they wish to go forward through it. I think there's a lot in medicine of this, of, you know, kind of a paternalistic trying to care for the patient, and certainly that's a big consideration of ours. But, you know, as a male, I have no idea what it is to carry a pregnancy, and certainly Dr. Shirazian has a lot of experience with these women, but I think, you know, there are risks as well involved in gestational surrogacy.
Surrogacy.
Yes, and there may not be, medical risk to the mother, but there's certainly medical risk to the surrogate. There are ethical issues involved in gestational surrogacy as well. Adoption, there's also societal and ethical risk as well. So we are not trying to necessarily supplant those options, but our main goal is to advise these women that this may be another option. You know, I think it's interesting to talk about the risks and then of the transplant, and certainly at this very early stage of the procedure, it does sound like a big operation. But I think over time, as surgeons and obstetricians and gynecologists and reproductive endocrinologists become more facile with the operation, kind of know how to refine the procedure, it'll become more of an acceptance. I think if you look at the long history of liver transplant way back in the 1960s and 1970s when they first started, you know, every liver transplant they did, the patient died afterwards, and they died death after death after death and death after death. And if you look at the original stories of liver transplant in the United States, there were a lot of these significant concerns. Why would we do this? Why should we do this? People keep dying. It's a waste. And over time, you know, the surgeons and founding fathers of our field, you know, persevered on. In order to provide people with this life-saving procedure. And, you know, at the end, liver transplant has become a standard part of our medical pantheon and surgical, you know, things that we can offer to people in liver transplant. So I think, you know, we and all the other centers and certainly the other centers in the United States and certainly the other centers internationally are very cognizant of the ethical risk. They're very cognizant of the large procedure that this entails. Mm. But we believe that this is a viable option for women who either financially cannot undergo gestational surrogacy or do not wish to adopt a child. And I think that, you know, over time, this will become a safe procedure and this will become a viable option to women who don't want to choose those other two routes of having a child.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new frontier in uterus transplants. The first in America failed this week in Ohio, but others have succeeded. More are planned in the U.S. We're looking at how it works, why people want to do it, whether it makes sense. Dr. Tarana Shirazian is with us. She is gynecologist, surgeon in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Joan H. Tisch Center for Women's Health at the NYU Langone Medical Center. Joins us from New York. Dr. Alex Maskin is here from Omaha, Nebraska, heads up transplant program at Nebraska Medicine. They are initiating a uterine transplant program. Medical ethicists Lisa Campo Engelstein joins us in a moment from Albany, New York. You can join us as well. Can you understand why a woman would choose to have a uterus transplant, to go through all that? Would you? Would you go that far? What about the cost? We'll look at that. Jean is calling from Simsbury, Connecticut. Hi, Jean. You are on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had heard you ask, and I'm not sure if it was answered, of who a good live donor would be. I've been an organ donor on my license, and I always assumed I'd have to be dead first. And in early stages of menopause at 50, I am really ready to not have my uterus anymore.
Oh, gee, okay. So you're putting your hand up to be a donor.
Here I am. I do not want to deal with the crazy cycles of menopause anymore, and neither do I want to have a baby when my kids are entering college.
Right, right. Jean is ready to surrender the uterus for a transplant. Dr. Maskin, who's a candidate? Can we do live donors in the U.S. at all? Tell us again. And in Sweden they do, just biologically. Who's a good candidate?
Yes, in Sweden all nine of the donors were living donors. Generally a good biological candidate is just a healthy woman who's had children. Who is in otherwise good stages of health, likely doesn't smoke or is obese. And in fact, the very first successful uterus transplant ever in Sweden, the first donor was a family friend of the recipient who was 61 years old.
So age is not terribly important, I guess?
No, age is you know, important in terms of general medical health, but it's just one of the factors.
You're right. Would the donor have to be premenopausal?
No. The donor can be postmenopausal. In fact, some of the ones in Sweden were. The expectation is that once the uterus is implanted, the hormones supplied by the recipient will essentially reverse the menopause of the organ and allow it to successfully carry a fetus.
And, and living donors in the U.S., remind us, did you say that can be done or cannot?
Oh, it certainly can be done.
Legally?
Our center and Cleveland Clinic are seeking approval for just cadaveric donors.
Mm-hmm.
I believe my friends in Baylor and in Dallas have received approval to potentially do living donors as well.
Gene, Dallas may be your ticket. I don't want to make light of it, but it is it's just human. Bill in Columbia, South Carolina. Bill, you're on.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the show.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly sympathize with the women who would be interested in the procedure. Unfortunately, you know, there are limited amounts of money available for health care in our country, and obviously it's very expensive. So one of your guests, I think, mentioned that a good candidate would be a woman who couldn't afford surrogacy. I don't know exactly, but I'm sure the cost of the transplant, rejection drugs, removing the uterus later,
mm-hmm.
would be 10 to 20 times what surrogacy would cost. And if the young lady couldn't afford it, those of us already paying high insurance premiums would do it. And if there are suddenly hundreds of uterine transplants, obviously insurance rates would go up. I hate to bring up finances, but that's reality.
Yeah, we have a huge medical cost in this country. Let's look at the cost. Dr. Shirazian, have you paid attention to costs at all here?
Absolutely. So I appreciate that last caller's comment. The IVF process itself is extremely costly.
Like what?
And I have many patients who can't undergo IVF because of costs in New York. You know, their insurance won't cover it. The out-of-pocket expense is a lot. It's on the order of $20,000, per year.
Wow.
Or sometimes, depend based on the drugs.
Yep.
And, based on if the insurance will cover anything. So, that number can change slightly, but it's expensive. And so women can't even do the IVF portion of this uterine transplant schema.
And of course, they have to do IVF after the transplant. So it would be the combination of costs. What about the transplant cost itself? Do you have a sense of what that is?
I don't, but we're talking about out-of-pocket expense because insurance, at least currently, will not cover it. And I'm not sure, given the number of people that will undergo uterine transplant, how insurance companies will justify that. I doubt they will cover it unless something dramatically changes. But we're talking about multiple surgeries. The last caller also said she would be interested in being a donor, which is great, but she should also understand that the surgery itself is a little more complicated than a simple hysterectomy.
A
lot more complicated. So less women may sign up for it off the bat. It's more complicated than just removing the uterus, as we would do if she were just having crazy cycles.
Dr. Maskin, if I may, just because he's planning on doing this in Nebraska, you must have a price point in mind. I'm sure there's a spreadsheet, doctor. What does it cost to have this done?
Well, all our research costs will be covered by the university. And if you look at Sweden's research, all of it was covered by a private foundation.
Out of pocket for the transplant recipient, how much?
A price point hasn't been set yet because but
you've got an idea. We know you have an idea.
Hundreds
like what?
Of thousands of dollars.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. From A to Z, including all the operative procedures, including all the monitoring, including the lab draws, including the IVF. Our expectations for people that we intend to recruit is that the only part of the whole process that will be paid for by their own insurance would be the childbirth.
Wow.
The delivery, the C-section, and the postnatal care of the infant, because
They got to bring some real bank along for this. Dr. Maskin, Dr. Shirazian, please stand by. Lisa Campo Engelstein joins us right now, professor at the Center for Biomedical Ethics, Education, and Research at Albany Medical College, also professor of obstetrics and gynecology. Got an article, The Ethics of Uterus Transplantation. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. Lisa Campo Engelstein, thank you so much for being with us today. What about the ethics of this? And let's just start, since we're on cost, hundreds of thousands of dollars, with all the needs out there in the world. Yet we understand some women really want and need this. Does this add up ethically to you?
Well, it clearly raises justice issues here, and we have many pressing needs that are life-saving. But much of medicine today is focused on quality of life and not just life-saving measures. So we spend lots of money on hip replacements or all sorts of other things that enhance people's quality of life but don't necessarily save it. And one concern I have from an ethical perspective is that historically and currently, reproductive medicine has often been relegated to the realm of not real medicine and sort of been sidelined as, oh, that's necessarily or inherently elective. And I'm not sure why we treat it that way. I think that should change, because what we see for women who experience infertility is not only do they have this medical condition of infertility, but they also experience extreme psychological distress and high levels of depression, as was discussed already. Mm-hmm. And so this could help with that as well.
But this is about carrying the baby. I mean, you could go to a surrogate to have a biological child. So all of this medical procedure, very extensive, and the costs, it's about carrying the baby. It's to permit a woman to have the experience right of carrying the baby. That's what this allows. I don't want to ask this in a way that seems insensitive, because I know that can be very important, but how do you weigh the value, the justifiable cost of that, Lisa?
Sure. That's difficult to do, and that's something that bioethicists sometimes talk about, is quality of life and how do we measure that. But we have drugs out there that extend people's lives by weeks that cost thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and someone says, yeah, that's worthwhile. It's hard to balance this, right? But I think we do have to listen to women's voices. And as was mentioned earlier, medicine is often paternalistic, or at least historically has been. And we need to listen to women and how this impacts them, how this affects them on a daily basis, and to see if this is actually a good use of our resources.
I mean, we've had callers, saying, look, this is a first world problem. You look at all the problems around the world, even in our own country. How do you justify? You raised the issue of justice. And again, I do not mean in any way to make light of an individual woman's experience. And yet, that's the kind of question that's been raised by a number of listeners. What do you say?
Sure. Well, the other thing I would say is the alternatives, as was already mentioned, mm-hmm. are not necessarily great. Adoption costs tens of thousands of dollars, and many people want an infant. The waiting lists are very long to get a healthy infant. International adoption raises ethical concerns as well. Surrogacy raises a host of ethical concerns about exploitation of women, especially poor women of color in the developing world. It also is extremely expensive, can cost $100,000, $150,000. So that's a good chunk of change for people to pay out of pocket. And then, as we've seen in the media with all sorts of cases, surrogacy raises all sorts of ethical and legal issues of who, quote unquote, owns this baby. Are we commercializing life? So this uterine transplantation could alleviate some of these other problems.
Dr. Shirazian, I guess it's my last time I get to come to you on this. Net-net, how do you look at this? You deal with so many women struggling and their partners struggling with infertility. Here's a path we can go down. It has all the costs and complications, but also payoffs we've heard today. How do you look at it?
Well, I think the one thing we haven't, or at least I haven't heard discussed to any great detail, is what is the benefit? So we talked about the psychological effects on the woman, the desire to have a pregnancy and a delivery, the value to that. What if she goes
C-section,
through everything?
We should be reminded.
And C-section. Mm-hmm. By delivery, I meant C-section. Okay, yep. I didn't mean vaginal.
Yep.
She goes through all of that, and then she doesn't have a baby in the end. What about the psychological trauma?
You mean if they lose the baby?
Emotional trauma. Lose the baby, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Because remember, even in the cohort in Sweden, of the 9 women, I believe it was either four that had live births.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not 100% effective either.
Right.
So
after all
it
that.
Is... Mm-hmm. We have to remember that as well, in the sense that if we had all of these costs, if we had all of this expertise on board, if we were able to do this and we could say 9 times out of 10, maybe 8 times out of 10, you know, the woman would have a live birth out of it, then that was sort of that's one thing. But if we say to them, you go through all this and then you have a 40% success or a 30% success, you know, I can tell you, I see women all the time where IVF doesn't work. You know, they spend $20,000, they undergo all the cycles, and at the end of the day, they undergo maximum amount of cycles and they do not have a live birth. And the emotional toil of that is significant as well. So I guess for me, I think we definitely need more data. I think that, you know, women can obviously make their own decisions and, you know, it should be offered if it is safe and effective, which I think we have yet to prove. And so I think a lot remains to be seen, but I don't think there's any magic bullet, you know, for pregnancy and for, you know, reaching that ultimate outcome of having a child, you know, if you don't have a uterus.
Watch this space. A lot of effort being poured into this right now and more to come on this front, even with the news of the failure this week. Dr. Tarna Shirazian at the NYU Langone Medical Center, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Lisa Campbell Engelstein at Albany Medical College, the Center for Biomedical Ethics Education and Research there. Thank you so much, Lisa, for being here.
Thank you.
I want to turn for just a moment with you, Dr. Maskin, to another area entirely, just because the headlines are in front of everyone this morning on the kidney front. And this is a big issue on uterus. We could go a long time. But we've got this new procedure on kidneys that makes rejection less likely. It may make it a lot faster for many people to get kidneys. What's the new development?
Well, it's actually a fascinating article, and I know the researchers at Hopkins and around the country have done it as well. The procedure
this is in the New England Journal of Medicine, yeah. Sorry.
Correct. Mm-hmm. The procedure they described, desensitization of antibodies, is actually not a new procedure. It's been done for many years. What I think is so exciting about Dr. Segev and the team's paper is that they've conclusively shown that across many different hospitals who undergo this desensitization process, that it's actually beneficial or more beneficial than the null hypothesis.
But does this mean that you don't have to get the kidney from a brother or sibling, a sister, or it can come from anywhere?
No. What this basically is showing is that a person who has a donor, let's say a brother wants to donate to a sister, but the sister has preformed antibodies against that brother. Previously, but currently, it'd be very difficult for that pair to be a donor and recipient because the antibodies present in the recipient would cause an early rejection of the donor's kidney. So for many years, protocols called desensitization protocols in which potential recipients would undergo rounds of medication, very expensive medication, to lower their antibody levels in order that they could have a successful transplant. The issue with these is that particular protocols are, again, very expensive, and that there wasn't absolute clear data that it actually worked in the sense that sometimes people would undergo desensitization protocols and would have lowering of antibodies. Sometimes people would have desensitization protocols, and it didn't change much.
We've just got half a minute, I'm sorry to say. This new way would lead to what? More easily transplantable kidneys? Received kidneys?
It's not a new way. Just shown that that this protocol of desensitization is beneficial, and that hopefully going forward, more insurance companies will cover the desensitization protocol so that more people can get transplanted. But the science is not new. It's the outcomes and what can happen as a result of this paper that I think has excited the transplant world.
100,000 people in the United States on waiting list for kidney transplants.
Yeah.
Have antibodies that would attack a transplanted organ, this may bring them hope. Dr. Maskin, both on the uterus transplant front and on this front, we thank you so much for being with us today from Nebraska Medicine in Omaha. Good luck, and thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.